My people, the night is beautiful, so the faces of my people. The stars are beautiful, so the eyes of my people. Beautiful also is the sun, beautiful also are the souls of my people. Profiles with Wendell Pierce.
Hi, this is Wendell Pierce, and you're in tune to Profiles with Wendell Pierce. And today I have a very, very special guest. One of the most special guests. Because we have a unique relationship. So unique, and goes back so far, that I actually can't remember a time where I didn't know him. So that's when it's really special, and it goes back a long way. This is a United States military veteran, an athlete, an intellectual, a writer, photographer, but mostly, most importantly, I know him as a great actor. We lived in a community when we first met in Brooklyn and Fort Greene, which was like a black arts mecca in the 80s, started in the 70s and 80s. And I think that's where we first met. He is a graduate of Howard University. He is a star of stage and screen. And today on WBOK, Profiles with Wendell Pierce, we have the actor, the extraordinary actor and Renaissance man, Isaiah Washington. Welcome, Isaiah.
Wow. Man, for a minute, I thought that was started like a eulogy.
No eulogy, brother.
I started getting a little nervous. You know, it's like, you know, they say you never know when you're dead. You know, that's where ghosts come in. You still think you're still in this realm.
Right.
But first and foremost, grand rising to you, brother Wendell. I have the utmost respect and admiration for your craft as well. and I'd like to congratulate you and all of those involved to keep WBOK in its present embodiment. I know how difficult it is for black ownership, how difficult it is to sustain that. It harkens back to when I looked at the Zoom, it said WBOK, and I said, wow, that reminds me of Houston, where I grew up, KYOK. And it makes me want to reach out and see if they're still on the air. And if not, if there's anything that I can do to help that, there's nothing more. I remember in the days that in the 70s, radio was our connection to the outside world, so to speak.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And without it, many of us, as you know, would not have been informed properly or informed at all. Mm-hmm. And let alone, we could not have a good fish fry in Houston on Friday without KYOK new radio playing, because many people, they assume that people can afford to go buy those 45 records and can buy the music. And I remember listening to the radio with all of what they told me with the hit song. I couldn't argue anything otherwise because they were playing the songs. I remember retaking my little cassette tape and recording the songs, and then being very frustrated when the DJ started talking before the song ended.
right. That's it, because you were recording for our back in the day playlists, right?
Exactly.
You drop by parties and everything. You say, "Hold on, look, hey man, put this on.
Put this in, yeah. I strapped
put this
my
in. This is mine. This is my mixtape."
Right. I strap it up. Or in my case, I would take some bungee cord and strap it on the back of my little bicycle rack that I used to get from Kmart. and throw on my little balloon and turn it backwards, and it'll make my bicycle sound like it's a motorcycle riding through the neighborhood, blasting Earth, Wind, and Fire, or Confunction, or Bootsy Collins. You know, it's like, I was doing my thing, baby. It's like,
man, and then you had, especially right, it's on your bike, and then you had your playing card.
That's right.
You had your playing card.
That's right.
I don't know how we rigged that.
Yeah.
To so it go through your spikes, so it sounded like a little bit louder.
Louder.
Like you had an engine.
Yeah, like you had an engine, man. I wrote my book how you attract all the dogs in the neighborhood and trying to outrun the dogs and not fall off the bike through certain neighborhoods, man. Yeah. Growing up in people don't consider Texas the South, but I consider the South.
Oh, yes.
It was always strange because Texas, you know, got the dances late. You know, we had to wait for the dances to go to the east, from the East Coast, go to the West Coast, and then end up at the Gulf Coast. So I remember in college and being in New York, and the DJ would be saying, hey, you know, the East Coast, where's the East Coast in the house? Everybody would raise their hands. Is the West Coast in the house? Everybody would raise their hand. And once I started making a name for myself, I put an end to that. And I walked up and then I said, look, if there's Gulf Coast in the house, raise your hand. And people started screaming.
There you go. See, now, I did not know that, first of all, we are almost the exact same age. Born, you were born, your birthday just passed. Happy birthday last month. My birthday is coming up in December, the same year. I did not know those two, you know, what I was saying earlier, how I can't remember when I didn't know you, right? I guess it was Fort Greene, but you grew up in Houston, and you were very near to us here in New Orleans. Did you ever have a New Orleans connection?
Absolutely. Before this interview, I was trying to think of this lovely lady's name, but you know, literally, it was 50 years ago. So I hope she doesn't hold it against me, but she was a very unique, beautiful African-American woman that somehow came into my life through the church. And she took myself and some others to New Orleans just when the Superdome had been built. And yeah. I remember that drive. It was 1975. So that means I was 12 years old. And I remember what's going through Beaumont, Texas, and then an area called Vida, Texas, mm-hmm. and how she asked us to lay down in the back seat. And I never understood what that was about, going through Vida, because she was afraid that the sheriffs were going to maybe pull her over and ask unnecessary questions. And I didn't realize at the time that even in 1975, going through this particular community, we were at risk just simply mm-hmm. for being African Americans. And I thought nothing of it, but I remember coming over the 10, I suspect it was the 10, and coming over the pass, looking to my left and seeing what I thought was a frightening, frightening thing. I thought the Superdome was the Martians, was a spaceship that had just landed. I, you know, coming from the Astrodome, you know, it was pretty a dome, you know, like a giant parachute that had been blown up. But mm-hmm. looking at that incredible design and the massiveness of it, it left an indelible impression on me on what innovation and art, creativity could do. And I was always impressed by New Orleans. I'm still say out of this two cities that I said, if I had to die in, New Orleans would be one of those cities. I've always been treated like a king. When I go to that, that lovely city, I've had nothing but the best time whenever I've been there. I've worked on two movies in New Orleans that I'm proud of. One was Hurricane Season and the most recent RZA's Cutthroat City. Kind of shortly, both are done shortly after Hurricane Katrina. And so I've always had a fondness of that city because my grandmother, on my grandmother's side, I have had relatives that were older than me then, I suspect that they made their transitions. They're no longer with us, but we're from an area called Palmetto and Baton Rouge and Shreveport. And a lot of the food and the energy always made me feel at home when I got back to New Orleans, and I know that people would just stop on the side of the street and says, look, man, if you haven't had any gumbo, you need to come to my house and have my gumbo.
Right, yeah, that's always the demarcation. Fruit gumbo is the best, you know.
Yeah,
you spend a lot of time in West Africa, so you know it's, you know, the gumbo competition in New Orleans is the equivalent of the jollof rice competition between Nigeria and Ghana.
100%. Yeah, for those who know, you're 100%.
So a question for you. So you're growing up in Houston, and you are from a military family. Am I right?
Yes. My cousins, most of my cousins, first cousins, again, who are no longer with us. And one of my living, I would say, cousin-in-law, my first cousin married this gentleman, and my stepfather, all served in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. In fact, my stepfather suffered from what we call PTSD, but now it's really PTS, because a lot of veterans today just said, look, it's not a disorder. It's something that happened to me from trauma, right, of being in war. I had to wake him up with a broomstick, Wendell, because he would wake up swinging. Every day of my life, I remember living with him. He would wake up as if he was still being attacked in Vietnam. He had a huge wound where shrapnel had gone through his left arm, I believe. And it used to always look odd because he had this huge knot where the surgery apparently was botched, and he just didn't heal properly. And it was kind of keloided.
Yeah.
So he had his scars, and unfortunately his scars scarred my mother and myself living with him, because we, no one understood. We didn't have access. It was taboo to go to a therapist in those days, right?
Oh yeah, you know, I remember, you know, my brother went through some difficulties when he was in school, and I'll never forget. We as a family went to therapy to be supportive of him, right? This like a little group therapy. And I it was, you know, don't speak of this to anyone, don't say anything, this is a very private thing. I thought, you know, it was it was the mafia or something, right? And it was so taboo. I think back on it now of how much pain and harm could have been avoided if that taboo had not been in our community, you know.
100%. 100%. 100%.
With everything that your stepfather was going through, it did not deter you from going into the military yourself, correct?
Well, yes, but I primarily ended up in the military out of spite. I was a very good football player at Willie Ridge High School, MVP. Got an honorable mention at the state level, Texas high school boy listed. And in my mind, my confidence and probably my naivete, I didn't understand how I was passed over for what we call a full run.
Right.
At the time, it was Pac-8. It wasn't Pac-12 yet, right? We had almost went to state. We lost a championship and did not get to state. But our division, my senior year in 1981, when I graduated. But the next year, with Thurman Thomas at starter, he was a 5-year starter. We took him, put him on a short bus, and took him out of Missouri City High School as an 8th grader, and he started on our. On our sophomore team.
This is major, man, because Texas football.
Yes, yes, sir.
Texas,
it's
Texas
a religion.
Football is the religion. It is
definitely. It's a religion.
the center of Friday Night Lights, the whole culture.
100%.
We have that here in Louisiana too. We share.
Absolutely correct. I remember there were some guys that ran track against that were from Beaumont Hebert and Galveston Ball. And we had many problems with these guys. Anthony Ketchum, I think it was his name, that ran the quarter against me. He ran then what was a 48. Now, a 48 was like a 42 today, you know?
Right.
It was just unheard of. Everybody was running 52s, 53s, 54s, and I lost against him. He pushed me to run. Actually, I clocked in at a 49 and lost against him and Craig James. Ernest Dickerson, that went to Lamar High School. I ran against them in 100-yard dash, placed third. These guys, what we saw back in the day in track, we call, they sucked me up. I thought I was in. Right. All I heard was.
So you were running against Dickerson?
Yes, sir. Who ended up, I think he's now a Hall of Famer. Yeah, Thurman Thomas is a Hall of Famer. Craig James had a great career at SMU.
So what position were you playing in football? So now you're running track, the 100, and playing what position?
I ran the 100, didn't do it well. After I lost, I was taken off the 100. put on the 220, because it's like I would start off slow, but in the end, I would pick up speed. So I was put on the 4x4 relay, 440 relay, and I was put on, I ran the 220. And it was interesting at the time because I was roughly about 100, you know, I was 175 pounds, and I played defensive lineman, which was technically what we call today a rover or a right outside linebacker or a left outside linebacker.
End that you would stand up on for.
Because we ran certain I formation, we ran options, we ran a lot of the I formations, which was very popular at that time with various plays with that. But for defense, we always ran the nickel, we ran the dime, we ran the 3-4 and the 4-4, and I was very good, very fast. So you had these good old boys and these big old coin eating boys that just weren't quick enough to stop me. So I was always, they start double teaming me. You would have the guys that were wearing.
I'll say it for you. So big old corn fed white boys.
You're not going to get me out there because you take one word from me. It's a headline. So I became very dangerous because I was small, but I was pretty strong. I stayed in the gym. I was small for my little body at the time. And I became very problematic for many teams to the point where they started double teaming. When you got total of 400 pounds, trying to stop 175 pounds, it's going to be a challenging game. But I was notorious for being a hard hitter. I cracked my helmet. I'm surprised I don't have CTE today, but I had multiple concussions because my mind, if I didn't have a good game, if I didn't crack my Riddell helmet. Once I hit a guy so hard, I cracked my helmet, you know.
Wow.
And
you are a prep superstar. Athletic in track and field and in football, you are probably a prospect. People are looking at you. You're looking to go to the West Coast, to the Pac-8 at that point before the Pac-10.
At the time, I thought I was good enough to at least get the Rice, be an Owl, or at the low end, or at least, I mean, my goal was to follow, you know, the great Earl Campbell, be a Longhorn, or what I really was, it was a deep secret, I really wanted to be a Buckeye. I wanted to go to Ohio State. So long story, that's interesting. When the scouts were out on my senior year, our final game, watching us get to, I think we were all scheduled and predicted to win state that year against my former school, Dulles High School in Sugar Land, Texas. It was a big rivalry and a big deal. I noticed that my coaches kept taking me out.
Oh, wow.
Although I started, it would take me out. And I'm like, I've never been, I played the whole, all four quarters, never been taken out. And I have a friend, Richard, and his name, last name, he's a pilot, and he still apologizes. He's Caucasian. He still apologizes to this day because he couldn't understand why he was being put in my position. As it found out was the first scandal I was ever involved with was unbeknownst to me in my high school. And what I didn't understand was I didn't get any what we call LOIs. We in our business, we call it a letter of intent.
But it's like a signing offer from in colleges for you.
Letters of interest.
Right.
I didn't receive, I got one. And it wasn't for a full ride. It was for a year-to-year offer to go to Texas Lutheran. And all the coaches wanted me to go to Mesquite, Texas, to go to Texas Lutheran. I'm like, I don't even know where Mesquite, Texas is. I'm not going to, you know. I mean, get me to Grambling or Southern, something. You know, who that talk about beating them Jags or something? Come on, you know, like, at the very least, I'm going to end up being a strong safety because of my size until I put on some more weight. I can't play defensive lineman or linebacker because I'm just too small. I'm probably, you know, I got to get my weight up. So
these coaches were purposely holding you out to to other athletes on your squad.
Yeah, and I didn't think of it because I'm a team player, Wendell. So I figured, you know, it's disappointing, but we still won the game. But we lost the major game. But it was odd, you know, throughout the season, I wasn't allowed. I had to alternate with this guy. And I'm like, well, I'm alternate. I like, because of me, we're here. And this guy is really a tight end. So why is he playing my position? Long story less interesting, I get upset. I joined the military because out of spite. And it was a time where you can join without your mother's consent because I was 18, you know, or turning, 17, get ready to turn. You could join in Texas at the time at 17. I turned 18 while I was actually in the military that summer. And when I graduated, I didn't tell any of my coaches. I can't say the names, but a lot of the coaches, one coach cried when he found out that I was in the military because he ended up coaching at SMU and was going to politicize and make way for me to go to SMU and continue to play with him, start off maybe in special teams and then ended up training me as free safety, strong safety, because I was pretty fast. And that he was very upset with me, and I didn't tell anyone. I didn't even tell my mom. I talk about this on my podcast. She was in the bathtub, and I was on my way. I was leaving the next morning, 4 in the morning, get on the bus to go to San Antonio, and she found out the day before I was leaving. And she took it hard, you know. She didn't understand. But at that time, you know, in 1981, that was the first recession hit, you know. Reagan had just came. So,
and it's also, you know, she's thinking about her, you know, her beloved boy, you know, and an opportunity that was there that could be missed.
Yeah.
Or whatever, you know, and
So
you understood that. You know,
and I didn't want to be a financial burden on her anymore. She was a woman with a 10th grade education, but she worked as a barber at the Jackson Barbershop in Houston, which is now a landmark. She was the first African-American woman in 1971 to receive a barber's license during a time where all African women were only allowed to get beautician license. They were never allowed to.
So Isaiah, what's your name? What's your mother's name? Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to, you would think we were talking to a Hall of Fame football player. who possibly could have been a Hall of Fame football player. I knew he was a great athlete, and it is actually seen in all of his work that he's very athletic. And I wanted people to know that you had that history behind you. We have a great sports program here at WBOK, great sports programming. And people might be thinking I'm talking to one of the great athletes, but this is Isaiah Washington, Renaissance man. And this is proof positive of his renaissance, because we all know him as a great actor, but he was a great athlete. But his mother was concerned, and but she is like all great mothers, especially all great Black mothers. She was resilient and forward-thinking and innovative. And you were just telling me about how she became the first Black woman with a barber's license. And what is your mother's name?
Faye Marie McKee. Yes, and all thing that at Pruitt's mortuary buried her. We buried her on a Sunday in Houston, which was a no-no. But that was in her will. She wanted to be buried on a Sunday. Now, you don't bury, have a funeral on a Sunday, because everybody that wants to, everybody's in church.
Right.
She wanted to be buried at high noon on a Sunday. I remember Jill Scott was in town. I could not find anyone to play the organ. The Pruitt's mortuary, all the people that knew me were angry with me. It's like, how are you burying Faye on a Sunday? Nobody's going to be there. Everybody wants to be. But ultimately, 200 people showed up to the wake, and about another 100 people showed up to her wedding. I called Jill Scott and tried to get her piano player. She says, oh, baby, I can't give up my piano player. I love you, but I got to do a show. So I was calling all around Houston trying to find a piano player that would play in a church on Sunday, you know, at that time. And we found this obscure little church that didn't have a big parish, you know. And somehow it happened. I had my wife's grand aunt, she sang some wonderful songs, and we got her buried like she wished on a Sunday in Houston, Texas. And only thing on her headstone window, it says her name, Faye M. McKee, and read under that in large words, what she wanted was barber. I buried her. Yeah, with her. She kept her clippers in her old royal crown, those little purple royal crown, little velvet little covers that you get with the whiskey.
Yes,
and
yes.
I buried her with her number one clippers and her trim, her trimmers. I still have her bowling ball. She was an incredible amateur bowler as well. She had a league, and he used to call Faye's Troubles. Anybody in the 70s knew the sister with the culottes on, the Google, you know, the choker and the afro. She was left-handed. I still have a bowling ball to this day. She was bowl a 300, like game after game after game. It was guaranteed, just strike after strike after strike. I grew up with at least 50 trophies that we had to manage every time we moved. And the older I got, the more we moved, the more trophies were broken. So she had about maybe 10 or 15 trophies left that was in the hallway. And I remember, you know, back in the day, you know, there was this little thing, like a little prism, like a little cone, a little green cone, and you put it up to the light and you look through it. It was a picture of my mom looking face front as she's bowling. That I wish I had to this day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you hold it up to the light and you can see my mom with this Angela Davis afro getting it in, bro. So my mom was famous long before I was. I didn't know how important she was to the community until after she passed. Yeah.
Well, you know, all due respect and honor to her for what she did for the community there in Houston, and for raising you and bringing you into this world, and all praises and honor in her memory. There's nothing like that. And as I tell everyone, you know, whatever you wish you told her, you probably did. Whatever you forgot to tell her, she already knew, you know, and there's nothing like a mother's love. And Isaiah Washington is demonstrating what a mother's love can produce, and the indelible power that it has, lasting long, long, long after they are gone. So to our mothers, and to yours specifically, Isaiah, God bless. Mm-hmm. We are talking to Isaiah Washington on Profile to Wendell Pierce here at WBOK. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back.
Love it.
We're back to Profiles with Wendell Pierce on WBOK. And our guest today is the great Renaissance man, athlete, writer, photographer, but best known as an actor, Isaiah Washington. And you talked about his childhood in Houston and his athletic career, and then he has joined the military, and now it is the military that leads him to the great university of Howard University. University, the yard.
Tell us how did
you get to Howard, and what was your experience like in Howard?
That was interesting. The step before that, like I said, was the military. I didn't know until I went home for a homecoming. I was already in the military, and I became very popular very quickly in basic training. I was made a team leader, squad leader. I've always been competitive, Wendell, extremely competitive. And obviously, you know why, because of what we do is highly competitive, right? But it was as I was at home, there's a term in the military called ate up. I mean, spit shine, crisp uniform, white gloves, saluting the flag, patriotic, just ate up. And my black coach, Coach Narcisse, saw me. He said, man, I don't recognize you anymore. It's like you're not the same kid. But, you know, meet me at the field house. I want to show you something. I met him at the field house that Saturday after our Friday night game, Friday Night Lights. And Willow Ridge won that game at homecoming. And they eventually went to state that same year. And he pulled out several envelopes, and they were letters of interest that he was told to withhold from me because the head coach was receiving a kickback to send off people like LeBlanc, not Thurman Thomas, but other players to smaller schools, because we were at that level considered blue chip players for them. And they would have gotten more money to their school had we gone to those schools. And he felt guilty about that. And he didn't want to leave this earth without telling me that. And Wendell, I turned to stone. I couldn't believe it, because now I got to do 4 years in the military. I've already planned myself. I'm doing 20 years in the military. I'm going to be an astronaut. I'm going to be a pilot. I'm going to do 20. I'm going to become the next General Washington now. That was my goal.
Right.
And
you were Air Force, correct?
Air Force. I was floored, man. And one of those letters was from Grambling, Southern University, and guess what? Ohio State.
Oh, my goodness.
And they didn't get to see me play because the coach took me out.
Wow.
Yep.
That's a story right there. That's a story. Has anything been about that? I mean, has any?
I keep talking about it, and nobody's calling me. No attorney's calling me to sue me and say I'm lying.
Right.
So, you
know.
That
is one of the great horrific crimes, and
a different form of slavery.
What you remind people of, just abject. That's violent, man. That's a violent act.
Yeah.
To bring about a lifetime of harm and scar to young black folks, man. Young black kids. You were a kid.
Moving us around like chattel.
That was criminal, man.
Yeah.
So from there, once you learned that story and you're in the military, how did you then become transition into an artist and then leave the military? And did you study at Howard?
No. Well, at that time, ironically, there's a gentleman named, I'll just call him Desi, who is we reconnected years ago on Facebook, but again, he's an extra on P-Valley, and he's like 6'4", 6'5", long, tall, incredible specimen at the time, and we ended up playing intramural football when I got stationed in the Philippines, and we became a dominant team playing people from Okinawa, Japan, and Korea. And I also ran track and obviously won multiple medals in the 100, 220, and the 440. So I continued my athleticism in the military with Dez, and we were pretty dominant while I was in the military. But unfortunately for me, Philippines Clark Air Base was very corrupt. And if you weren't doing what everybody else was doing, then you would have probably been hurt. I seen a couple of people literally get killed in strange ways on the flight line because they didn't participate in the black market or participate in doing a number of things. And I got involved in those things and did very well. I would get my rations of cigarettes and sell them off in the black market for a lot of money. And Techniques in Iowa was, and Pioneer was the speakers at the time. So I had something like 8 speakers in my dorm. I would throw parties and people would never question me like, where are you getting all this money from? Because you can't just be you're making this money here. But everybody kind of knew what everybody was doing. I probably made I buried like $750,000 in a duffel bag. I was stationed in the Philippines, and I think quite honestly, when I look back on my life in that time, it was a very dark period of my life. I got there, I was there, hit the ground running, got caught up in all this stuff for 6 months. And I remember one of my majors bringing me into his office and demanding that I write a letter to my mom because I promised her I would call her when I arrived. 6 months had passed by, and I got caught up so fast that she thought I was dead. She had called the Red Cross. She thought I was dead. And I wrote a letter begrudgingly because I was full of myself. I was making money. And I had changed. And she knew I had changed. When she talked to me on the phone, she says, you know, my nickname is Mickey. She says, Mickey, you don't sound like my Mickey anymore. What's going on with you? And obviously, I didn't tell her. And I think, you know, I had to go undercover in a way. I had to be two people, the good airman and then, you know, the baller. By night and the good airman by day. And that's where I believe my acting skills began, whether I knew it or not, being able to deceive others or make them believe I'm something that I'm not. But it was doing it in order to survive. And once you start making that kind of money, it's kind of hard to turn back at 19, right. You know?
Oh, yeah. So you did find that duffel bag, didn't you?
No, you
left it underground.
No, it got bad because I ended up, you know, challenging a superior officer that I was working with, and I was going to infiltrate the Contiki bar, which was only for whites. And I figured since we're in business together, I could spend my money and drink and buy prostitutes, do whatever I want, right? I'm a baller, right? And a big, you know, brawl ensued, and me and some of my, you know, coworkers or buddies got into a brawl, and I ended up getting shot and had to conceal that by getting Trobesin off base because I couldn't go to the hospital on base to get the penicillin. And if you got penicillin, they had to ask you why. So I couldn't afford any questions. So I had to go underground. I survived that. I talk about this on my podcast, Isaiah Washington Speaks Again on Spotify. And
Say that again. I want the people to hear it so they can know.
Oh, you can pick up from my high school time. I'm still 19 years old on my podcast. It's called Isaiah Washington Speaks Again on Spotify and Google. You can download it there.
Fantastic.
And when I survived that window, I said, you know, again, I turned to God and said, you know, if you get me out of this, I'll behave. I would never get myself anything like this. I was doing LSD. I was being caught, nearly arrested for DUIs at the time. You know, you're high on LSD. I was trying to hurdle over the cracks in the sidewalk. I was going to call that a short story. Where the SP security police arrested me in the rain because I was trying to run in between the raindrops. And I said the rain couldn't touch me. I was soaking wet. And they said, Airman, you need help. And I did. And they got me to help. It wasn't like, you know, what do you call it, any intervention, but it was what we call their form of an intervention. Like, you're going to kick you out of the military if you don't get your act together. You know what I mean?
Right.
In order to leave, I was put on what they call international hold. Doing an investigation because one of my comrades was murdered, and they murdered him. They said over trying to steal what they call patico, the locals there, the Filipino men that were pretty treacherous and pretty bitter because we were there abusing them and their women. So in their minds, they didn't like Americans, and they certainly didn't like African Americans. And one was murdered, and until that investigation was over, I couldn't leave the country. And at that time, things were getting hot for me. So I figured, you know, I need to clean house. And that's when I did what I did, because there was no way I could afford to have them look through my suitcases or whatever, and extra duffel bags, and they go, wait a minute, you know, I got all this money. That was, would have been federal prison time. Right, but I was at a high level. We were doing some pretty high level, sophisticated things to move weight, so to speak, from Farragut and Aircross. I remember I told a story where I put so much weed in a parachute bag in the F4 Phantom that is supposed to be stop the aircraft, slow it down. That the guys I was working with forgot to put the parachute in it. So when the plane landed in Korea and skid off the runway, there was marijuana. We lit the little matchboxes, diamond matchboxes with the matchsticks. I would fill it up with what we call Thai stick, which was very popular. People couldn't get that marijuana, so they were looking to our team to supply it. And nothing, all the marijuana flew out the back of the aircraft and onto the flight line. No, no.
So you had underground economy, as I call it.
Hey, man, but here's the thing I learned about the government and learned about capitalism. No one said a word. And no one said a word. They just looked the other way. And at 19, that helped and hurt me, my psyche, because I'm going, well, if I can get away with this, what can they get away with?
Right. So now we have a limited amount of time here. And so I do not want to give short shrift to a lot of things that I want to talk about, but I could not let that story and your telling of it not be fully realized, because what you try to do on Profiles is go to a deeper level of the person's experience. And so I just wanted to tell you how much I appreciate that. Yeah. And I don't want you to think that I'm giving short shrift to your career.
No,
you know, so
you
did a multitude of films. Did you study acting at Howard?
When I got out of the military, I ended up 2 years at Alamogordo University. Alamogordo, New Mexico. And that's where I met my first wife, and she was in the Army. And I got married on my 21st birthday, a day after my 21st birthday, August 4th, against my mom's wishes. But the cut two, that's what brought me to Washington, D.C. I got a job in the private sector in Gaithersburg, Maryland. I was working for a company that sent me to Sweden, and I was working in logistics, piece parts. And I detected that, you know, certain parts have life shelf, what we call a life shelf life. And I noticed that a particular seal had timed out. And I was trying to send everyone that would listen that, you know, we may need to stop selling these seals because they're effective. Well, come to find out, I think if the story is still clear in my mind, one of those seals were used by NASA. And that was one of the seals that broke that ended up blowing up a space shuttle. In that mind, my mind, I felt personally responsible for that, you know. And I think I was suffering from depression and didn't know it at the time. Mm-hmm. And I just walked away from my marriage. I walked away from my job. I became, you know, distraught and just wasn't focused on the job. Ended up losing that job. Ended up homeless. Ended up working for Kelly Temps in D.C. Ended up at IBM. Working, and had a crush on this young lady named Cynthia, and she said, well, in order to date her, I had to go to her church. So I went to her church, and she said, well, no, not just go to church, but you have to become saved. I did that, and the lust went away, and I had a love for Jesus so strong that all I wanted to do was do faith-based plays in the black local black churches. I met a musical director named Malcolm that said, you know, you have a real talent. You need to take it seriously. And he gave me a book by Oscar Brockett, and it was called Stage and Lighting Design. And mm-hmm. I read in that passage about the Howard Players that was created by Ossie Davis at Howard University.
Yes, so indeed.
While I was still working as a temp and still sleeping in my car, I was selling pots and pans and non-stuff, clocks up, you know, whatever portfolios, folders on the back of my car. I ended up going to Howard looking for the Howard Players. So they sent me over to the music department. The Howard Players, now world-renowned musical band. And there is no more theater. So I met this lovely woman named Vera Katz, who still gives me notes to this day at 84. I think she's 84 now.
Vera Katz, the world-renowned acting mentor and teacher at Howard University.
Yes.
I met her a few times. I worked there one summer.
You did? You know Vera Katz? Oh, I didn't know that. Oh,
yeah. Okay. And
well, you know, I'm not making this up.
Oh, no, yeah. Kelsey Colley and all of those.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yeah. Yes.
She is world renowned. So go on. You were saying.
Yeah. And I ended up auditing, didn't have the money, drove back to Houston and sold my mom china that I got while I was making money in the military and sent her all this fine china and silverware. She hocked it all, gave me the money to matriculate. I was there, Wendell, for one semester. I did not graduate. And at the time, I got an audition for Diane Houston, who was actually the first African-American woman to receive an Oscar nomination for Tuesday Morning Rise, starring Ruby Dee and Bill Cobbs. She allowed me to audition for her in New York in 1988. And I was told that I had a 2-year degree in aerospace engineering at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. So when I went in, as a somewhere between a junior, top junior to a senior. So if I had two semesters, I would have graduated from Howard in arts management. Mm-hmm. And I was told by Carol Singleton that, okay, you know, you got this job, we'll give you, like Blair Underwood, you don't have to come back and sit in the class, we'll give you life experience credits and you can get your degree. Well, that wasn't true. That didn't happen. They wanted money. They wanted me to come back and actually sit in the class. But at that time, I was already rolling, you know, with City Kids repertory. We founded Lisa Nicole Carson. We brought in Malik Yoba. We dealt with theater and education. I ended up at Creators Art Team with Zelda Fishlander at the time, working through her wonderful program and non-traditional casting. And then I started making my name for myself at the Negro Ensemble Company and Woody King. I painted their studio. I was proud to paint Woody King Jr.'s new Federal Theater studio. And I was working as a sound designer, assistant sound designer. And I got to see Sam Jackson on stage and Rain or Shine on stage at the great Negro Ensemble Company and started making a name for myself as a carpenter. I was known as Ike as the carpenter and then Isaiah as the actor. And then I got an opportunity to work for Breakdown Services. Breakdown Services was as a messenger, you go door to door, agent to agent, to drop off these breakdowns for actors.
So the way it works in our business, ladies and gentlemen, is producers are doing film, they're doing television, they use Breakdown Services. It comes down, it's a breakdown of the job. This is what the story is. These are the characters that we're looking, and we're looking for actors of, you know, this gender, this age, whatever. Please make your submissions to this casting director with your clients. And this is a breakdown service that is primarily used by agents so that they can officially make their submissions of their clients. I want my clients going for this role. Here's the picture and resume, and schedule an appointment. Now, if you were a messenger for Breakdown Services, I know where this is going. Breakdown Services, and you're an actor, That means you get the breakdown before anybody else gets it.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So, you know, I skipped the beat, but when I was depressed, a friend took me to go see She's Gotta Have It. And that's when everybody thought I lost my mind, because they said, I'm in 10 years, I'm having my master's degree from Howard, and I'm going to work in 1996. I'm going to work with Spike Lee. Well, I was on that trajectory. By the time I got through Breakdown Services, I got an agent. I was come up, lie on this resume, create all this stuff, pretend I was at this thing, and they knew I was lying, and ended up getting auditions for voiceovers, started making money there, got All My Children, Guiding Light, As the World Turns, One Life to Live, and then segued into plays at the Goodman Theater, got cast in Skin of Our Teeth, the 20th anniversary to play Henry.
And I remember this time because I'm at Juilliard 81 through 85. Mm. So I remember when you arrived. So I guess this is when we first crossed paths in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. We are That's living right. there as artists.
That's right.
We were working around town. Like you said, I remember you working with Lisa Carlson and Malik Yoba. You guys were going into the school and actually yes. developing stories with the yes. kids and all of yes. that stuff. Because I did a thing called the Playwrights. There was a playwrights competition at Playwrights Horizon. Young Playwrights.
Of course, Festival. Playwrights. Yeah, on Theater Row. That was the place to be. I went through a playwright doing yeah. stage reading. Well, you can actually make $300 doing the stage reading back in the day. That was a lot of money.
Right. And then also you would, and then also you, and a token, right? And you
get yeah, token. For the train.
Right. Yeah, man. So you were happy. You know, okay, I got my yeah. train fare. Yeah. And I remember you guys, I think you guys actually had an office, the program that you were talking about, where you guys went into the schools and all. You were on Theater Row, too. I remember uh-huh. then. And then I also remember the time you were working with the public theater and non-traditional mm-hmm. casting.
Yes, yes.
I was in a company with Estelle Parsons.
Wow.
Estelle Parsons put together a non-traditional, you know, just a diverse Shakespeare company.
Yes. Yes.
And Keith David was in that. Mm-hmm. I was in it briefly. And
was Andre Brower part of that? Or was he at the Folger? Andre Brower.
Andre went to the Folger. He was in school when that was happening. He was at Juilliard, which would have been his master years, because he undergrad did Stanford. And then what would have been his master years were at Juilliard. Juilliard just gave you a certificate. They now give you a master's. Back okay. then, if you had gone to undergrad and you went to Juilliard, they just gave you a certificate and said, you went to Juilliard, right?
Okay,
and that,
right.
that was the program that Andre was in, Andre Brower, but when he soon left school, he went to the Folgers and was working at the Folgers. And so it was all around the same time, I would say about 86 to about 90. And then mm-hmm. I remember when you were doing all of the soap operas, too, as you were mentioning. Mm-hmm. You're doing yeah. all the soap operas. But yeah. now, here in Fort Greene, where we were living, Spike has his office, Spike Lee. And I yeah. remember, like, you know, Spike was always in the community. We all recognized each other, saw each other. And then it really had this sense of being this Black bohemia, right? This Black artist bohemia on par with the Harlem Renaissance. This was happening in the late 20th century in Fort Greene. And I remember you established yourself with Spike. I see you with a catalog of films with Spike Lee, Crooklyn and Girl Six. And then ultimately, we finally worked together.
Get on the bus.
Get on the bus.
Right? Get on the bus. Andre yeah, Brower as well.
We actually worked together again. We worked together again out in L.A. a little
in Bullworth, but didn't know we were in the same movie.
I know. We didn't even know until we went to the premiere. I said, what you doing here?
What
you doing here? It's my movie. Oh, we're in the same movie. But no, talk about your relationship with Spike. How did that start?
I stalked Spike Lee because of She's Gotta Have It. I finally earned my resume authentically. And I would... You know, he drove around in that big SUV that he got out of South Africa. So he would leave the windows cracked. So I would slip my pictures and resume in his truck, and it didn't work until I did Strapped, which was the directorial debut for Forrest Whitaker.
Well, we are now in three movies together.
Wait a minute,
on Strapped.
I gotta go watch that again.
That's when I first met Forrest Whitaker.
Yeah,
I think it may have been a public defender or something. And I think what survived was just me saying, you know, yes, Your Honor, you know, I have an objection, but that's okay. You know, one line or something. Like that. But that's when I met Forrest. So he was
good. Yeah. Oh, cool. And from there. From there, it took off, Wendell. Robert Reed got me an audition for Crooklyn. Obviously, I got the role. You know, everybody was going after that role. Leon, Cuba Gooding Jr., Federal Star, he ended up getting in there. Everybody was in there because everybody was hiring rappers. And then from Crooklyn, I lived in Fort Greene, so Spike would invite me over to his brownstone and say, I got a script for you called Clockers. I want you to read it. And he was on his way to a Knicks game, and he would say, when you finish reading it, lock the door. And he found this young actor named Mekhi Phifer. He says, I want you to do a scene with Mekhi Phifer for Universal Studios because he's a new actor, and I want him, but they don't know if he can act. So we did a scene, and the rest is history. His career took off from there. And then he called me again. And I went to his house and I read Girl 6. I got that job.
Brooklyn is a brilliant film.
It was a very personal film for him.
With Mekhi Phifer, we were just talking about it. I'm having a senior moment. That's not Crooklyn. Yeah, that is Crooklyn.
Mekhi Phifer.
Clockers started
him as my little brother in Clockers. Mm-hmm.
Right, Clockers, yeah. Mm-hmm. Clockers, brilliant. Richard Price novel adapted by Spike. I think it's one of the most brilliant films in its canon. So you did Crooklyn and Clockers, and then Girl 6.
Then my starring role, and people were mad at me because I got paid $75,000, and apparently that was the most money he had paid anybody ever. That wasn't Wesley or Denzel. And a lot I heard the Turturro brothers were pissed off. Everybody was pissed off when they found out that I got paid that amount of money. The movie was interesting with Susie Laurie Parks. It was until he wrote it, he rewrote it, and my mind wasn't as good. But we got it done. And then from there, he offered me, he got game. And I couldn't do it because he, you know, at this time I'm used to making some money, and he wanted to offer me what we considered scale back then. And I chose to do Bullworth, and I didn't work with him again until Get on the Bus. And when I read that script, I did Dancing in September, Reggie Rock Bythewood starring in that as a TV executive based on.
Right. So folks will know, Bullworth was a Warren Beatty film.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think they should re-release today. It's so relevant. I think it's more relevant to today than it was 20 years ago.
Absolutely. A political film. He's running for Senate in California. He's disillusioned with the whole process, and he's very depressed. And this was not pulled from the headlines. This is what he created then, which is actually in the headlines today. He hires someone to assassinate him.
Right.
To make a political point. And I was thinking of the film the other day when I was reading the stories of this lawyer who is now has been arrested and is going to be tried. He hired someone to kill himself in an insurance fraud.
Profiles with Wendell Pierce has been brought to you by the National World War II Museum, located in the Warehouse District of New Orleans. The National World War II Museum tells the story of the American experience in the war that changed the world, why it was fought, how it was won, and what it means today. Visit them online at www.nationalww2museum.org for time tickets and safety information.